Nobody can be too Jewish.
That's exactly it. You got it.
Shalom and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Karen Reb Rudel, who gives virtual tours of Jewish Paris. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on Two Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. Two Jewish is paid for by Two Jewish Radio Programs and Podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. The long run of Jewish fall festivals has finally concluded with the celebration of Simchat Torah last week. We've now entered the Jewish holiday-free season that lasts all the way up to Hanukkah. There's even a special name for the month that begins tomorrow, Cheshvan, the single month in the whole Jewish calendar that has no holidays, believe it or not. It's called Mar Cheshvan, literally the bitter month of Cheshvan. But if you, like me, happen to be in the professional Jewish business, there's something rather refreshing about the conclusion of this month-long overload of holiday happenings in Tishrei. After a non-stop glut of festivals, celebrations, fasts, and feasts, it's actually a relief, a mechaya, to get back to something akin to regular life. Don't get me wrong, I love the Jewish holiday season, and each festival has its own meaning and beauty. Each explores an important aspect of ritual and communal life. Every single festival, from Slichot through Rosh Hashanah to Yom Kippur, from Sukkot to Shmini Atzeret and Simchat Torah, has something unique to teach us about how to live life well and meaningfully. But while this is an exhilarating period filled with festivities, it's also an exhausting time with many additional demands and requirements for a rabbi or cantor or both, like me. And that means that when we finally settle down to just regular Shabbat once a week, we can really appreciate the virtue of a day of rest and joy that only comes every 7 days, instead of what can seem, during the holidays of Tishrei, like 3 or 4 times a week. I guess at some point, you can get too much even of a good thing. However, it's not truly possible to get too much Shabbat, in my opinion. The Sabbath comes weekly to remind us that whatever else happens in our lives, we can, should, and need to take a full day to focus on something other than work or our daily routine. And that day can become a time of holiness, peace, and spirituality if we do it well, even if right now we're doing it mostly at home, like, well, almost everything else. Which means we have to make a little different effort during this pandemic time to make Friday night and Saturday a special day. Bake challah beforehand, for example. Make a special dinner. Put a white tablecloth on the dining room table. Fill a kiddush cup. Light candles. Maybe log on to an online Shabbat service, you know, like the ones we do at Congregation Beit Simcha. Make your own Friday night and Saturday a day of rest, family, music, and joy. And so to play us in this morning, here's a Lecha Dodi, one of my favorites, from the Moroccan Sephardic style by Chazan Aaron Ben Susan, welcoming the Sabbath. Lecha Dodi Likra Nekara Ne Shabbat Teka
Hey!
That was Lechado Di, the song of welcome for the Sabbath Bride by Cantor Aaron Ben Susan for Shabbat, coming this Friday night and Saturday, and every Friday night and Saturday. When we return in a moment here on To Jewish, our guest, Karen Reb Rudel, will give us a tour of her virtual tours of Jewish Paris. Find out how it works. Get a taste of the Jewish community of Paris without flying during coronavirus. All when we return in a moment on To Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun. A place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town. Amazing dining and top flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball. Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson, the Catalina Foothills, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this fall. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has already created a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A new progressive congregation in northwest Tucson of the Foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. You can join us for limited in-person attendance, masked, during blended Shabbat services if you call 520-276-5675 in advance and request attendance. And of course, come on Facebook Live, where everybody can come. Beit Simcha Synagogue is located at 2270 West Ina Road, just west of La Cholla, near the entrance to the Foothills Mall property in our own building. Services, classes, and events are open to everyone in normal times. During the days of coronavirus tsuris, join us every Friday night on our Facebook page for Shabbat evening celebration services at 6:30 p.m. Saturday, Shabbat morning services are at 10 a.m., all with me leading them. Facebook page is Beit Simcha Tucson, B-E-I-T-S-I-M-C-H-A Tucson. We have our services with full music virtually for the time being. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are on Zoom. You can access that by emailing me at rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org, B-E-I-T-S-I-M-C-H-A, Tucson. Synagogues at 2270 West Ina Road, west of La Cholla, on the north side of Ina, at the entrance to the Foothills Mall in our own building. For now, we are a fully functioning virtual congregation as well on Zoom and Facebook. For more information about Congregation Beit Simcha, to attend services, our great religious school and Torah Tikes program, bar and bat mitzvah, confirmation and high school programs, and rich array of adult education academy courses taught now on Zoom and in blended format, and of course all of our services on Facebook, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, B-E-I-T-S-I-M-C-H-A Tucson, or call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the newest and fastest-growing Jewish synagogue community in all of Southern Arizona in its exciting beginning years. We are delighted to welcome the two Jewish our guests this morning. Karen Reb Rudel is a tour guide in Paris of the Jewish community and has, in this time when we all wish we could travel, but it's not such a great idea, created a virtual tour of Paris, of Jewish Paris. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
Thank you.
All right, so first of all, start out by telling us something that we definitely don't know about the Paris Jewish community.
Well, we only have, out of about 200 synagogues, only about 8 are not Orthodox and modern Orthodox. A lot of Americans don't realize how traditionalist most of the French Jews are, and that about 80% are also Sephardic and not bagels and cream cheese like American Jews.
That's because of the large influx of Jews from former French colonial territories like Morocco, Algeria, Tunisia, and so on?
Exactly, exactly. It's the same food, it's the same religion, just a lot of different food and customs.
When you tour people around Paris to the Jewish community, where do you start? How do you begin?
We start in the Marais area. The whole tour is in the Marais, which is the oldest Jewish quarter of Paris that's still left, you know, in its heart today. Most Jews have moved out to other areas, but it's where most of the people come on Sundays to support the community. At Place de Vosges is where we start.
And by the way, the Marais, one of the most famous Jewish neighborhoods in the world, I would say. It's become kind of hip, though, hasn't it? Like, it's kind of gentrified.
Absolutely, because the most of the Jews moved out because they were such, you know, huge Orthodox families. They had to find cheaper housing a little farther outside the city. And it's a big neighborhood now, so it's very much like the Village.
Right. So it's sort of funny. We can expect to see the big gay ice cream shop open up in the Marais sometime soon.
Exactly. Exactly.
What's the oldest existing Jewish place or oldest existing Jewish entity within the Marais?
During my virtual tour, and actually my real tour when you're here, we sit in the oldest synagogue in Paris dating back to 1698, and it's where Rabbi Schneerson prayed for 7 years when he attended the Sorbonne University.
So 1698, well, you know, a century almost before the French Revolution. There's not much of medieval Paris left, is there?
No, but that is the area that it is in. It is in that medieval area.
Right. We will talk much more with Karen Rebrudel about Jewish Paris and her virtual tour, which you can find online, when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at toojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's toojewishradio18@gmail.com. Or visit our website at toojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store. As very popular Jewish podcast, top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine, with 100,000 downloads. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We've been talking about the small but incredibly complicated community of Montenegro and its non-existent, but it turns out to be there, Jewish community. Tell us a little bit about its revival and some of the family names, some of the story there.
Right. So recently, in one of our regular phone calls, I had a discussion with the Chabad rabbi there, who's the only rabbi within hundreds of miles, and who does absolutely terrific work. He's tireless, energetic, kind, and his wife and children support him in his work. They're really a team. And I asked him, I said, so are there any communities in Montenegro that are big enough to make a minyan, which is the quorum of 10 Jewish adult males that the Orthodox community requires for prayer service? And his answer was very interesting. It was, there are, but they don't know it yet. I said, what do you mean by that? And he told me several anecdotes that I'll abbreviate here. But the first was, so this is a Chabad rabbi. So he wears a black hat and a long black coat. And you can see from across the street that he's a rabbi. He's checking out of a grocery store and waiting in line for the cashier. And the woman who's at the cash register is wearing a crucifix around her neck. And she says to him, are you a rabbi? He said, yes, why? She said, I'm a Rosenberg. So he said, oh, where is your family from? And she said, originally from Vojvodina, which is that area of northern Serbia that lies between Belgrade and Budapest. And then he said, do you have any family here in Montenegro? She said, about 200. All originally from Vojvodina.
All Rosenbergs.
All Montenegro Jews,
right,
from the same family. And that's only one family. Okay. Then he tells me about an encounter he had at a government reception with one of the most senior Montenegrin diplomats who's been in the diplomacy game a long time. He used to work for the Federal Republic of Yugoslavia, and he happens to be a Muslim, not necessarily a devout Muslim, but a Muslim, both by name and by affiliation. His wife is a Greenstein. And the Chabad rabbi meets the wife, says, "Do you have any relatives here?" She said, "Oh yeah, dozens, all from Vojvodina." So at some point, it turns out that Jews from Vojvodina decided that their chances of surviving World War II would be better in Montenegro than in Vojvodina, because if any foreign power occupied them, it would be Hungary rather than Germany. Plus, Montenegro was notoriously difficult to conquer completely because of the terrain. It was just impossible for any foreign power ever to rule it totally. A little bit like Afghanistan, in the sense that the Brits tried and lost three times to rule over Afghanistan. Nobody's ever completely ruled over Montenegro, including the Montenegrins themselves. They're very tall, ferocious people. If you see a group of Montenegrin teenagers traveling in a European airport, you always assume they're a basketball team because the shortest guy will be 6'5", and they'll go up from there. They're quite a unique people, but the interesting point is that this rabbi believes, and he's making his belief a reality, that there are enough Jews in Montenegro, even those who are not necessarily aware of their Jewish identity or who have received no Jewish education, but if he puts on events that are attractive, they'll come, they'll discover their Jewishness, they'll start doing one mitzvah at a time, and he will build a Jewish community where, at least theoretically, none has existed in hundreds of years.
Fascinating. And it's true in many places now around the former Soviet Union, behind the Iron Curtain, other places. Really interesting stuff. Tom, thanks very much. We will finally leave Montenegro next week and go somewhere else.
I look forward to it.
Thanks. It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie New, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. One day, a gorgeous woman gets on the bus, clearly distraught, sits down next to a guy. She's visibly upset. Finally, she can contain herself no longer. She turns to the guy and says, "I just saw my therapist. He says I have a huge problem." "What's the problem?" the guy asks. She says, I can't tell you. I don't even know you." And the guy says, "Well, sometimes it's good to tell your problems to a perfect stranger on a bus." So the girl says, "Well, my therapist just told me I'm a nymphomaniac, and I only like Jewish cowboys." That feels good to let that out. "By the way, now that you know, my name is Susan." And the guy says, "Hello, Susan. My name is Bucky Goldstein." That might just be my all-time favorite Jewish joke. Anyway, that was the old Jewish joke of the week special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. Now a word of Torah. This coming week in Temple, we'll read the great portion of Noah about the most famous sailor in all history, a man who rode out the storm to end all storms in an ark. Here's a song from a forgotten Broadway show on the theme of Noah called 2x2, starring the late Danny Kaye. It's about what happens when you finally get off the ark, a delightful song called When It Dries.
It's natural 2x2. It's wonderful going boating with a floating zoo. Those who meet God's terms can come. Pachyderms can come. Teeny worms can come. Even germs can come if they come together 2x2. 2x2. It's logical 2x2.
It's comfortable
2x2. It's catchy, no?
2x2. It's practical.
God has decreed to, therefore you need to.
Ham's got, Shem's got.
Go and get what them's got, Jaffy, 2x2. Go make yourself 2x2. And climb aboard, plenty room for you and you know who. Lots of things are done by one.
Looms are spun by one.
Races won by one. Ships are run by one. When it comes to families, two by two. The creepers are. The crawlers are. The flyers are. The brothers are.
Donkeys and monkeys all brought their bunkies.
Camels and crickets all got family tickets. Chafee, two by two.
Don't hesitate.
Two by two. It's time that you did what me and Mama used to do. Will you hug and smooch, you will. Bet your boot you will. If she's cute, you will. Feel so mutual. In a bed, it's better. Two by two.
Here they come.
The song When It Dries from an old musical, 2x2. Music for that was written by one of the most successful Broadway composers, Richard Rodgers. Of course, he was Jewish. And his most famous partners were the Jewish Lorenz Hart and the descended from but not raised as a Jew, Oscar Hammerstein. And, of course, Danny Kaye was Jewish. And, well, Noah was not Jewish, since Judaism hadn't been invented yet. In any case, the great tale of Noah is shared to one degree or another by other ancient books of lore and legend, most notably the Sumerian Epic of Gilgamesh, another guy who had to build a big boat to save humanity. But rather than read to you an ancient Akkadian, I thought David Steinberg's version of the moral of the Noah story might play better.
Shem, Ham, and Japheth, all three of whom had an IQ totaling 17. The Bible states explicitly that Noah was a righteous man in his generation. The Bible does not add words. Why do they say in his generation? Because we find out later on in Genesis that Noah liked to drink. He was, in fact, a drunk. The Bible states it clearly. Later on, Clifford Odets backs it up. My contention is this. If you had to live on a boat with 10,000 mating hippopotami, and those three sons for conversation,
there's just something inherently comic about being stuck on a big boat with a whole bunch of animals. After the Garden of Eden story and the Exodus tale of the crossing of the sea, I suspect Noah might be the single best-known biblical text of all. It's probably a combination of all those animals and the rainbow. With those two symbols, you get everyone from preschool kids to college co-eds' dorm rooms. And once you toss in that dove of peace, you have another oft-used and universal symbol. Tons of marketing opportunities for the manufacturers of toy animals and rainbow pillowcases, too. But like so many biblical tales, there's more to that story than meets the eye. It begins, after all, with people doing evil, and it ends with more people doing more evil, in spite of the flood and the ark and the dove and the rainbow. The real message is that we need to do something beyond mere symbols or leaps of faith to motivate us to be decent, good human beings in society. We need the structure of justice and morality that the Torah ultimately provides. Civilization means we must follow basic standards of conduct in the service of creating a world in which we can all live without bringing destruction on ourselves or upon our own world. So may it be. When we return on to Jewish, our guest, Karen Reb Rudel, will tour us around Jewish Paris, explaining how she brings people to France virtually and interactively without ever getting on a plane. Find out how that works when we return on to Jewish in just a moment.
We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Israeli and Lebanese officials began direct negotiations over their maritime border in the Mediterranean Sea. That marked the first time the two nations have consulted over a non-security issue in decades. Officials from both sides met in the Lebanese border town of Nakoura, stressing that the discussions were not a step towards a normalization of relations, God forbid. Two of Israel's Gulf Arab semi-neighbors, the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain, recently signed peace deals with Israel, opening the door for full diplomatic relations and increased trade and tourism. Lebanon and Israel are technically still at war, having never signed an official peace treaty, after decades of brutal conflict beginning right after Israel's founding in 1948. The Lebanese militant group Hezbollah is one of the region's main violent terrorist aggressors against Israel. We're not talking about peace talks or negotiations over normalization, but rather the attempt to solve a technical economic problem that for a decade has prevented us from developing natural resources in the sea for the benefit of the people of the region, said Israeli Energy Minister Yuval Steinitz. At stake in the talks, which are being mediated by the UN and the U.S., is a zone of over 300 square miles full of natural gas claimed by both countries. Lebanon hopes an agreement would help its ailing economy, which has one of the highest GDP-to-debt ratios in the entire world. The latest prominent right-wing American to advance conspiracy theories about Jewish philanthropist George Soros is Ginny Thomas, a conservative activist and the wife of Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas. Ginny Thomas shared a meme on Facebook last week claiming Soros' family is evil and really, quote-unquote, running the Democratic Party. The meme, first posted by a right-wing conspiracy theory page called The Great American Movement, shows a compilation of photos of Democratic figures posing with children of Soros, the Jewish American hedge funder and Democratic donor. A caption reads, "Who is really running the Democrat Party? The Soros family." The original post also says, "George Soros is training his family to carry on his evil legacy." Soros has become the leading avatar of right-wing conspiracy theories, including vicious anti-Semitism. Republican officials and activists, as well as far-right extremists and conspiracy theorists, regularly assert, without evidence, that he is secretly funding or in control of a broad array of liberal causes, or otherwise out to undermine the U.S. government. This conspiracy theory originated in the anti-Semitic propaganda of Hungarian dictator Viktor Orban, but has found a fertile home among Republican political operatives in recent years. A recent ADL survey of tweets directed at the 30 incumbent Jewish members of the House and Senate found that Soros conspiracy theories accounted for 39% of all the anti-Semitic tweets, including allegations he funds and organizes Black Lives Matter and Antifa protests, and the careers of all Jewish politicians and journalists. The idea that rich Jews are conspiring to secretly control world leaders is, of course, an age-old anti-Semitic canard. Ginny Thomas has a history of sharing falsehoods from the Great American Movement Facebook page. In the past, Justice Clarence Thomas's wife has shared false posts from the page accusing Democrats of committing voter fraud, calling California a war zone, and claiming Barack Obama wiretapped the Trump campaign. This year, following repeated calls from civil rights activists, Facebook has finally aimed to crack down on anti-Semitic content. It announced recently that it will ban posts about Jews controlling the world, pages promoting the anti-Semitic QAnon conspiracy theory, and posts denying or distorting the Holocaust. About time, Mark Zuckerberg. In other news, a man who plotted to blow up a synagogue in Colorado pled guilty to federal hate crimes and explosive charges last week. Richard Holzer, a self-described skinhead and former Ku Klux Klan member who used Facebook to promote white supremacy, was arrested last November for plotting to blow up a 100-year-old synagogue in Pueblo, Colorado. The synagogue, Temple Emmanuel, has 35 member families. Holzer was arrested after plotting with a man he thought was a co-conspirator who was actually an FBI agent. Holzer had previously attempted to poison the synagogue's water supply with arsenic. This is the most important work we can do, protecting our communities by stopping an attack before it occurred, said Colorado U.S. Attorney Jason Dunn. A Department of Homeland Security report released this month concludes that white supremacists pose the biggest domestic terror threat in the United States.
ילדה שלי קטנה שזאת תהיה המלחמה האחרונה.
HBO Max has bought the rights to Valley of Tears, a drama about the 1973 Yom Kippur War that is being touted as Israel's biggest budget TV series to date. The 10-part series depicts the war through the eyes of young soldiers through four different plot lines. It stars Lior Ashkenazi, familiar to international audiences from his role in Israel's acclaimed film Foxtrot, and his part opposite Richard Gere in Norman. The series was created and co-written by Israeli-American writer Ron Leshem, who wrote HBO's Euphoria, and Amit Cohen, who wrote the popular Israeli thriller series False Flag. The pair at work on another Israeli series seems like they just keep coming, called Traitor, a thriller currently in post-production. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish our guests this morning. Karen Rebrudel is a tour guide of Jewish Paris. In particular, she mentioned earlier in the show the Marais, the ancient and still to some degree Jewish area of Paris, even if lots of Jews have moved further out to the suburbs. Karen, how did you get into this in the first place?
Oh, very quickly. I'm from Johnstown, Pennsylvania. I went to school in Philadelphia and studied music and theater. Came for a 30th birthday, and that was 22 years ago. I started giving tours out of a youth hostel when I pointed out some things to my parents when they visited. And then I got married and had a kid, and I met a woman who asked me if I did Jewish tours. And she said, you need one. And now for the past 10 years, I've been giving the Jewish tour 4 to 5 times per week since 2010 when my little boy was born.
So obviously the pandemic, the whole coronavirus COVID-19 problem has dramatically curtailed tourism to Paris, which is, I assume, kind of the soul of what keeps you working. How did you conceive of the online version? And tell us a little bit about this virtual tour of Paris.
I started to try to think about a YouTube channel, but then I thought, well, how's that going to make money? You know, I started to just do that thing. And there's a lot of people doing so many different, you know, reinventing themselves. And I figured, let me try this and see if I can bring it to life in photos. And what's very interesting is now I'm finding that I could reach people that are might never come to Paris, forgetting about the pandemic, but financial, physical, age reasons. I'm actually doing, I have an independent living home in Tucson that has booked me once a month. You know, people who aren't going to go anywhere. And they're all Zooming in their rooms, or they're doing it in one, you know, activity room with a giant screen. I'm getting groups of friends and families. I've just started to book some synagogues. And it's really, you know, I have to remarket it and restart all over again. But, you know, that's what we do. You know, I'm just trying to be an entrepreneur.
I like how you say entrepreneur. You've been in Paris for a while, haven't you? Tell us how people find it, and then I want to dig back into the Jewish community of Paris.
Well, they're not on my website yet, which my company is called Sight Seekers Delight, but they're not embedded on the website. They can just email me at KarenRebrudel@gmail.com. That's KarenRebrudel@gmail.com, and I can send them all the information, and you know, we can find a date, and it seems to be working very well. That's about an hour and a half program with a Q&A after that's lasting anywhere from 10 to, you know, 20 minutes, half hour. I open the meeting usually 15 minutes before for everybody to kibitz, and it's slowly starting to work.
What's your favorite part about the Jewish tour of Paris?
The lunch break. You know, we were pressed, let's eat. You know, we all know the old joke. But that seems to be when I have a group, and also interestingly, in Paris, my tour is 65 euros. You know, now I'm down to, you know, 18, 20, 25 on the weekends. When I give a tour, it's a, you know, usually a 3.5 to 4 hour tour. I'm honing it down to an hour and a half. It's kind of attention deficit disorder. I'm trying to get you all the juicy stuff, kind of cliff notes of Jewish history. I don't want to bore anybody. I want everybody to get in and out. I do a nice series. The last usually 10, 15 minutes is all about the Holocaust. I have had over 2,000 Holocaust survivors and family members on my tour, so a lot of my stories are coming right from them to me to you. And everybody loves to get a good falafel. We skip the line, and that's when everybody gets to chat with each other.
So the Jewish community of Paris goes back to really almost the foundations of Paris. But the Jews were expelled from France on a series in Middle Ages a number of times, and yet always invited back by the next king or two kings later.
Exactly. Kick them out, invite them in. Kick them out. Well, because we had to be the money lenders, we were the doctors, and, you know, we were doing everything. It's still one of the reasons it's one of the third largest Jewish communities. You know, the French were the mothers of many inventions, and that's why the Jews still flock here today.
Is Paris is one of, if not the largest Jewish community in Europe, if I'm not mistaken, correct?
Oh, yes. We have about 550,000, give or take. But sadly, when I started giving this tour 10 years ago, the population was 680,000. So it is a community that is, you know, you do have a lot of people leaving to go to Israel. You know, that's kind of like the Jersey Shore for a lot of the Sephardic Jews.
Right. They're all moving to Nahariya and right along the coast.
Netanya. There. Yeah. Netanya. All the street signs are in French. Yeah.
Yep. So a fair amount of drain towards Israel, but still that's a community the size of, say, Southern California's Jewish community. I mean, really large.
Yes. I mean, I think we're the third largest in the world, Israel, America, and then France.
Right. We hear so much about anti-Semitism in France. Have you experienced it? What's your experience of it?
And that's obviously one of the first questions everybody asks while I'm holding my sign waiting for them to walk up. And I wear my star with pride. However, I'm not Orthodox, so I'm not wearing the gear. But plenty of my friends that are Orthodox are wearing the outfits. I have not met one person personally in 22 years who's ever had a problem. However, saying that, it's never been easy to be chosen. You know, choose somebody else next time.
Yeah,
but I had a lot more problem growing up in Johnstown, Pennsylvania, a very small town, not as good education system. And when I moved to Philadelphia, everybody was Jewish. So any big city, from what I see, it's a little more, you know, better education. Plenty of, you know, I have Muslim friends. We have Jewish friends in my building. We have a party every year. One of the tables is marked halal and kosher. You know, you're hearing a lot, and it's more outside of the city. I'm not saying it's not happening, but it's more Marseille, Toulouse, Lyon. It's less, you know, the cities that are a little bit smaller than Paris itself.
In touring, in virtually touring, besides the ADD aspect of it, what's the biggest difference when you're doing a virtual tour as opposed to, of course, you can't get the falafel, but as opposed to doing one in person?
You know, I am a comedian, so it's very hard that I can't get the laughs, you know, right at the same time. And I throw in a lot of great comedy, and I try to make it very digestible because, you know, that's part of us. You know, in this tour, I really try to teach everybody that not only were we the professionals and the educators, but we're also the writers, the artists. And I go through
the filmmakers, you know, all of it, right?
Yeah. So we have the French have a huge Jewish community here of people that have been here for a very long time and have definitely made their mark on the world. A lot of people don't realize André Citroën, the Citroën cars, a lot of the famous artists, obviously Chagall did the roof on the opera. And I'm able to bring that into life, you know, in picture form. And I find that it's a great educational tool virtually.
Jews were such an integral, well, I guess still are, an integral part of the development of French culture. Do the French respect that? in your experience?
You know, the French, and that's one of the best parts about a virtual tour. We don't have to deal with any French people, except if my husband passes by. You know, hey, I married one. I can say whatever I want. But basically, it's not the French themselves that hate the Jews. The French hate everybody.
Yeah.
You know, don't get it misconstrued. The French are very difficult. You know, since the Dreyfus Affair, the weight has been lifted a lot. Obviously, World War II, and a lot of times when, you know, my husband's friends found out I was doing this, and they said, please tell your clients that we were also all hiding Jews. You know, nobody that your husband knows was a collaborator. All of our families were doing what we could to survive and also help Jewish people.
Yeah, nobody supported the Vichy regime in the whole country, I think.
It was very small.
Yeah. There were six Frenchmen that were involved and maybe two French women. Everybody else was in the resistance. Sorry to be cynical about it. What's your favorite French Jewish joke?
Oh, French Jewish joke?
Well, yeah, it doesn't have to be in French. It'd be better if it were in English, frankly, but...
One of my favorite jokes, my father's 89 years old. I made sure he, you know, told me I could tell all these. So there was I'm sure you've heard them all, but the old Jewish couple goes to the doctor, they're not feeling so well, and the doctor checks them out and says, you know, looks like you guys are in good shape, but you have a little herpes. So they go home, and the husband says, let me look it up on Google. He says, honey, the doctor made a huge mistake. Herpes is only a disease of the Gentiles. You know, that seems to be one of the good...
Okay, I really like that. I don't know if we can tell that on the air, but we'll find out really soon from our radio station here. When you tour, you know, so much of the Marais, you know, it goes back into history, but while it was a vital and vibrant Jewish neighborhood, as you mentioned, it's become quite a different kind of neighborhood. There still are kosher restaurants. There still are the synagogues.
There are 80 kosher bakeries still in Paris and over 200 kosher butchers in Paris and the surrounding suburbs.
Oh, my goodness. You know how many kosher butchers are in Tucson, Arizona? Zero right now. But anyway, go ahead.
Well, it's interesting because the Muslim population is happy to eat the kosher meat.
Right. It qualifies for halal. That's right. Yeah.
Exactly. So, you know, and I've been to Morocco personally 5 times. Mm-hmm. And when I go to the Souk, you know, it's called the Souk.
Yep.
You know, I wear my star. And if they don't bring out the tea... and the carpets don't come down, they're not, you know, I'm not interested in doing business with them.
Sure.
You know, they
sure.
call me cousin. You know, really, I've had no problems. It's very interesting because everybody thinks that we do have problems. And after the Charlie Hebdo and the kosher supermarket incident in Paris a couple years ago, I actually got a phone call from the secret Jewish Protection Agency asking me if I wanted a bodyguard during my tours. And I said, I'm not real sure how comfortable, you know, I feel about that. But there's cameras that have been pointed out to me, and it's the most well-protected area of Paris.
When you tour Americans around the Marais, virtually or in person, what's the thing they're most interested in?
They all want to know what's happening with anti-Semitism. It is the first question, the last question, the middle question. It's always, you know... That's always what they want to know. They love hearing the information. You know, when we sit in the synagogue, I start talking about the first, you know, evidence of Jews being here up until the Charlemagne. I go through the Rashi. You know, I go through the expulsions, the, you know, everything, the blood libels. I go through all of that. Then we go to lunch, and then we go to the Shoah. And in the interim, everybody always pulls me aside to say, how are they with anti-Semitism? It's very intriguing when I'm living here and not feeling it at all other than the news. We have bullying and then terrorism, you know?
Yeah.
And since what happened in America with the Tree of Life Synagogue, that's when all of the American Jews realized that, you know, it's everywhere.
Right.
You have cemeteries everywhere that are getting defaced.
I assume growing up in Johnstown, Pennsylvania, they blamed the Jews for the floods there. I'm just guessing.
You know, I've never heard that one, but I did get picked on when I was a kid. It was me and one other kid, And then, you know, I cried to the principal. Everybody came to my bat mitzvah, and we're all friends on Facebook now. But right. It was not easy. It was not easy.
Sure, sure. No, I think we become aware that it's not only overseas that we can find anti-Semitism these days. In doing these virtual tours, do people then come back? Do you take them to the synagogues during, like, on Shabbat? How do you handle things like that? There must be such requests.
You mean
when you're doing them live as opposed to, you know, virtual?
I do have certain synagogues that I send people to. We do have a great American rabbi here, Tom Cohen. He's from Oregon. He's
good,
just
good last name. Good last name. Misspelled, but a good last name. Anyway,
exactly,
go ahead.
Exactly. His wife is the first woman rabbi in all of Europe. Now we have 4 women rabbis in France. And like I said, there's out of the liberal synagogues in Europe, we have more women rabbis in America than they have liberal synagogues in all of Europe, reform synagogues in all of Europe. It's a small, small community.
Sure, sure.
So, but the Orthodox open their doors. The Chabad is a huge movement here.
Sure.
And when we go into the little synagogue, all the Chabad, they wrap everybody with tefillin as long as your mother was born Jewish.
Right.
You know, they're very, you know.
As long as you're a man and your mother was born Jewish. Let's be specific.
Yes. I do have a great story for you. Appreciate this.
Please
I had
do.
A convert on the tour. I get lots of converts on the tour. And, you know, he wanted to wrap tefillin. And I said, well, you can talk to them. They're from New York. You know, they probably won't do it because your mother wasn't born Jewish and you didn't convert Orthodox.
Orthodox, right.
Well, they said, sorry, we're happy you're Jewish, but we couldn't do it. And at the end of the tour, he said, you know what, Karen? Boy, was I happy that they thought I was man enough, but not Jewish enough. Because not only was he a convert, he was also a transsexual.
Transgender.
Transgender, yeah.
You know, it's an interesting Jewish world these days. Karen, where can people go to find out about your virtual tour of Jewish Paris and to connect with it?
Well, they can write to me specifically at KarenRebRudel@gmail.com. They can look at my website, Sight Seekers Delight, SightSeekersDelight.com, and you can see the Jewish tour that's already been listed. I have 16 different walking tours. I am now currently working on a resistance virtual tour because the actual, you know, can't do it for real anymore. So I'm trying to make those virtual. It's a whole new world.
It is a very new world. Thank you so much, and I hope when I get to Paris next, I'll get to take an in-person tour with you.
Thank you very much, Rabbi.
Thank you, Karen. When we come back on Two Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun. A place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town. Amazing dining and top flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball. Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Two Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Our playout this morning comes from a gorgeous setting of the evening prayer, Hashki Venu, by the late composer Max Helfman, in a fine performance from cantor Shiri Kidron. Join us next Sunday. Our guests on Two Jewish will be Laura and Ellen Distelheim, daughters of author Rochelle Distelheim, the 90-something-year-old author who passed away just before the publication of her new novel, Jerusalem, A Second Language. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week and a week, we pray, of health and of peace. Meinu beitz
שומרנו מצילנו, אל שומרנו מצילנו.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.